Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Tyson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Colorado, Denver, and I'm co-host of the channel, along with Carrie Figdor, Robert Talese, and Alexis McLeod. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Perry Zern, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at American University. His book, Curiosity and Power, The Politics of Inquiry, is just out from the University of Minnesota Press. Is curiosity political? Does it have a philosophical lineage? In Curiosity and Power, The Politics of Inquiry, Perry Zern shows consequentially, yes. He further asks, who can be curious? How? When? To what effect? What happens when we are curious together? Engaged with multiple social movements ranging from the mid-20th century to our current time, and thinkers of curiosity from the ancient world until now, Zern theorizes the normative and political force of curiosity while providing insights into how it has and can be wielded for transformative collective resistance. Perry Zern, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
I'm delighted to be here.
Well, will you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background as a theorist and how you came to work on a book about curiosity?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a political philosopher by training, and I focus on studying forces and histories of change. And for me, that means I ask how change happens in our minds and in our bodies and between people and institutions. And I focus in particular on political resistance and curiosity and transgender life as separate loci of transformation. But sometimes these topics bleed into one another. And as you'll see in the book, Curiosity and Power, all three are certainly present, despite the fact that the title simply names curiosity. So that's a little bit about me and a little bit about what I do. But how I got to this particular book, I feel like you can tell this story from a really personal angle, or you can tell it more professionally. And so I'll start with the personal. I grew up in a context that was particularly conservative in all kinds of ways, religious and political and otherwise. And although there were certainly avenues for a free-ranging curiosity in my education, I was homeschooled, but in other senses, my curiosity was incredibly constrained, and there were appropriate ways to practice it and appropriate topics to practice it on, and then there were clearly inappropriate ones. So there was a lot of policing of knowledge in my youth. Nevertheless, I was entirely enthralled by knowledge itself or by the process of inquiry. I've just always loved school. And I count myself lucky that I'm now a professor and I get to just be in school all the time. I wanted to continue on and go to college. And at the time, because of my sex assigned at birth, my parents said no and just get ready to get married. But I ended up finding my way a little bit late to college. And when I got there, I thought, I've made it. I've found some freedom, and now I'm going to be able to kind of practice my curiosity on anything and in any direction. But what was fascinating is there, again, I found these constraints on my curiosity and ways in which there are certain topics that are covered in higher education and certain ones that aren't, certain lineages that are tracked really, really carefully and others that are entirely, you know, jumped over. And so there's something about that, this feeling that where I thought curiosity would be most free, it still wasn't. And that the reasons for that seem to be social and political and in some cases religious commitments. I just thought, wow, there's something here to think curiosity more deeply. And so from there, I think I developed what some people call a breadcrumb curiosity, which is I just started kind of noticing where the word shows up in my life, in my work, in philosophy in general, as I went through grad school. And the more I noticed and thought, suddenly I thought, you know, first of all, there should be more books about curiosity. There should be a deeper interrogation of specifically curiosity and sort of the political structures that inform it. And so I think that's that really long tail is how I got to writing Curiosity and Power. That's the personal story. And then the more professional one, I would say, was in one of my very first graduate classes. So I finished undergrad and I went to a very small religious college and didn't get in anywhere for graduate school my first year of applying. So I ended up paying for some graduate classes on my sort of night school on my own at Villanova for a year. And one of the courses I took was on Martin Heidegger's Being in Time. And somewhere in the middle of Heidegger's Being in Time, there's a section on curiosity, and it's a dramatic takedown of curiosity. And I was somehow assigned to present on this particular section, and I read it and I read it and I read it, and then I read the St. Augustine passages that Heidegger's working with, and kept thinking about them and noticing, you know, I feel like there's something funny going on here. I feel like both Augustine and Heidegger's characterizations of curiosity were pretty feminized. So curiosity for them is sort of gossipy, it's flighty, it's superficial, it's unreliable, it's generally just not very insightful. And I thought, you know, there should be a kind of a feminist analysis of this particular reading of curiosity. And so I tried to start one in my presentation, and I just remember the presentation falling entirely flat. And I feel like I got no echo in the classroom or from the professor. And there was something about that moment that was, for me, I mean, as an outsider, right? I was there among the real graduate students who were actually in the MA or the PhD programs. And I had just been denied acceptance at all the graduate schools I had applied to. And I just felt, so I already felt like an outsider. And then I thought I was bringing something outside of the text, but that really we needed to bring this feminist analysis to the Heidegger and Augustine passages. And there just wasn't an echo or a resonance. And something about that was entirely humiliating to me, but also frustrating. And there's something about that frustration that honestly, I think it was a harrowing moment that just, you know, I couldn't let curiosity go, and I couldn't let it go that I had something to say about it that needed to be said. So I also do track the book back to that particular moment. And as you can see in the book itself, there's not only a really deep feminist analysis, but a race analysis and a disability analysis and a trans analysis. And I'm just really trying to bring issues of social marginalization to the topic of curiosity, at least as it's treated in philosophy.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting hearing that story about the seminar, because I hate it for you personally, right? Like the, excuse me, the combination of humiliation and then frustration. But yeah, the book that it gives rise to, in a way, I hope like people can focus on the arc of that, like the meaning making out of the experience of frustration, humility, right? Like that is a long process. This is a work of over a decade, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And the like way that you stayed true to that early impulse is amazing. Yeah. Which I think takes us to this this major theme of the book, that curiosity is political. Mm. And there that you work that theme throughout the book, it returns. And so would you talk about that? Because one of the things that you constantly point to is the way that curiosity works on both sides or multiple sides of struggles, of political struggles. And so how did that become a guiding, or not so much how, but like, how is that a guiding theme of the book?
Yeah. So when I think about, when I state that curiosity is political, what I'm trying to communicate is that who is curious, when and how they are curious, is informed by social values and political structures, and in fact, political struggles. So there's never an instance in which curiosity exists outside of social values or outside of political structures, and it just happens or appears and is practiced on its own. Curiosity is always, for me, embedded in that social political milieu, and therefore is political. So that's part of what I'm trying to communicate when I state that curiosity is political. But then once it's political, of course, that doesn't mean that there's only one way in which it's wielded, because there's certainly all kinds of political structures, all kinds of social values, and therefore curiosity takes different forms or formations in each case. And so one of the ways in which I open the book is I talk about Sarah Bartman and Zora Neale Hurston, and these stories emphasize that kind of contrast in the formation of curiosity. So Sarah Bartman was a woman from South Africa who, as you may recall, around the turn of the century, the 17 to 1800s, she performed in freak shows and on other entertainment areas in England and France. And she was treated as specifically the instance of a difference. Her blackness and specifically her black womanhood were the object of certainly ogling and in an entertainment setting and also in a scientific setting. So she was also studied by scientists during her life and then after her death, again, as an instance of a difference. And this kind of curiosity is expressly, in that case, colonial, anti-black, and certainly misogynist, and that's a formation of curiosity that was specific in that historical and geographical moment, but certainly also has resonances to lots of other times and cultures and settings. But by contrast, I also tell the story of Zora Neale Hurston, and specifically of Alice Walker, the famous writer, finding the burial place of Zora Neale Hurston. So Zora Neale Hurston is an anthropologist in the early 1900s, and she is remembered for doing a tremendous amount of work recording black folk songs and folklore from the U.S. South. And that was her work, and it's just an incredible legacy. But she was relatively forgotten by the time of her death, enough that her writing and her work really had to be recovered by the likes of Alice Walker in the 1970s. And Alice Walker talks about, you know, she tells a story of growing up as a black writer and the ways in which patriarchy informed her pantheon of black writers, the ones she knew, the ones she thought about were men. And she lived her, you know, she went through her high school, she went through college, she went through publishing her first short story, and never, she says, I never knew about Zora Neale Hurston. And what is it to not have that legacy? What is it to not have access to your own history, right? To histories of black writers as a black writer. And she ended up kind of getting word of Zora Neale Hurston and decided to track down where it was that Hurston was buried. And she went to Eatonville, Florida, and writes this wonderful essay called Looking for Zora about the experience. But there's another curiosity. There's an insistent, I need to know this person. I need to know their work, and I need to find them. And that's again, if we're talking about how curiosity works and how it's formed, there's love there, there's intimacy there, there's belonging there, there's a resistance to a white supremacist narrative of writers, but also a patriarchal emphasis on Black male writers at the time. And so what that offers a contrasting lens through which we see curiosity doing something different. And so I open with this kind of contrast and say, what does this invite us to think about curiosity as political in both cases? For in the case of Sarah Bartman and in the case of Alice Walker's discovery of Zora Neale Hurston. So that's at least, you know, the beginning of where I start with the question of why curiosity and how curiosity is political.
Yeah, and it's multiple ways of operating, I guess. We'll say we'll get more into operations. Not quite the right word, I think.
No, that's good. I like it.
Well, so one of the ways you contextualize the book is to give a political history of curiosity and its vicissitudes through time. And you have, you know, sort of three big eras, like ancient, medieval, and modern stories of curiosity. Curiosity has very different ideological or dominant understandings in these different eras, but you link in each case curiosity to exclusion. And so I'd love for you to talk about that relationship between curiosity and exclusion and how it works out differently throughout that history.
Yeah. So this chapter, the political history of curiosity, comes from perhaps again a different frustration, which is the preconception that philosophy doesn't have a whole lot to say about curiosity, or that curiosity hasn't really been tackled by philosophers in the past. And there is this conception, especially among more contemporary analytic writers. So part of the work of this chapter is to say, well, actually, there's been a lot of incredibly rich philosophical, theoretical engagement on the topic of curiosity, and we have a lot more work to do to unpack it and to pay attention to it. So, and this also comes from a certain, I guess, frustration with this, with the ways in which folks responded when I first said I wanted to write a dissertation on curiosity. It was the response was, well, that's not really a philosophical topic. There isn't really stuff for you to do there. And I thought, yes, there is.
Yeah.
So that's part of where this particular chapter is coming from. And also it's the breadcrumb curiosity showing up. As you can tell when you read it, it's I've been listening to a whole lot of texts and reading a lot and just kind of tracking the little breadcrumbs of where curiosity shows up in the history of philosophy. But besides all of that, I do think it's really important to mark that curiosity in the ancient and medieval periods is disparaged significantly and is treated as something terrible, something you don't want to practice, either in whether you're sort of in a secular setting or in a religious setting. It's something that takes hold of you and turns all your best qualities against you and breaks your relationships and distances you from the truth. And it's just, you know, it's just not a desirable quality. And in doing so, interestingly, in the ancient and medieval periods, it is aligned with specifically women, slaves, the poor, people with disabilities, colonized peoples. It's dismissed as something those folks do. Those folks practice curiosity. Whereas if you're serious, you're going to study, you're going to be marked by studiositas instead of curiositas, and kind of a rational wonder, reason and wonder. Now, what happens, I mean, one story that really captures this, I think, is the work of Apuleius, who wrote a book called The Metamorphosis. And this is the first fully extant Latin novel to survive for us today. And in the story, Apuleius is telling the narrative of Lucius, who is apparently a very well-made man and of high class and high wealth and good reputation, but he has a character flaw. He's tremendously curious, and he's specifically curious about magic at the time. And he just cannot get it out of his mind. And he ends up meeting some, quote, witches or magic women who engage in magic, and all he wants is to have them transform him into a bird. He thinks that being a bird, specifically an eagle, would just be wonderful for a knight. And but unfortunately, the spell goes poorly, and he ends up becoming a donkey or an ass. And in this, and this is what curiosity does to you. First of all, it turns you into an animal, which is interesting. Mm. And it takes away your high class status and your high reputation and your access to wealth. And he ends up hanging out with robbers and thieves and people who are condemned or treated as criminals, and lower class women. I mean, the story, it's the demise of a man, apparently. That is what curiosity does. So that's really the ancient and medieval conception. But then in modern philosophy, we can think of specifically Rousseau and his treatment of Emile. Jean-Jacques Rousseau talks about what it means to really educate a proper citizen. And he centralizes curiosity. And he says, in fact, curiosity is the bedrock of a productive citizen. But that citizen is now classed, is a young man, is able-bodied, is part of a, not the colonized, but the colonizers class. And so curiosity suddenly takes this, just has this entire flip for what it stands for. And it's being reclaimed in that moment in the early modern period. And there's all kinds of explanations for why this is happening. You know, there's a certain demise of the Catholic Church and the rise of secular science, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what's important for me to emphasize in that story is that as curiosity gets lifted up, gets reclaimed, gets kind of washed off, dusted off, the folks who were disparaged for their curiosity remain disparaged. There's no change in their status. So curiosity gets saved, but folks on the social margins don't. And it's specifically, it's that. That's just a moment where you start to see curiosity and politics having this longer story together. Sometimes they're coming together for one practice and then separating for a different practice, and that's just intriguing and also inviting for us to say, okay, we're one of these. We're people who've really inherited this modern sense of curiosity as wonderful, great, let's do it. It's central to what it means to be a human and a citizen and a global citizen. So if you type in global citizenship and curiosity, there's lots of literature on it. But what might be buried in that sense of curiosity that still supports a mistreatment, a disparagement, a sidelighting of women's concerns, people of color's concerns, poor people's concerns, people with disabilities concerned, and their practices of curiosity? How are they going unrecognized while a cleaned up curiosity, a normalized curiosity gets lifted up?
Mm-hmm. I mean, to go back to the story you told about the seminar, right? There was a way in which you were being disciplined into a practice of curiosity. In that moment, right? And so, yeah, consonant with the story you're telling. Mm-hmm. And so then you take us, you kind of give us that broad overview history, and then you take us to what you call episodes from political theory. And these episodes are really centered around the work of Nietzsche, Foucault, and Derrida. And as you point out, I think really wonderfully, these are three curious people in the history of, like, they are sort of seen as being curious figures in the history of philosophy. But they're also three people who appreciate curiosity with these varied forces. And some of the language that I saw you employing to talk about how they understood curiosity was like freezing, immobilizing, confining, dissecting, also subverting, upending, and abolishing. And so I'm interested in how these three thinkers form the core of that episodic approach to curiosity and political theory.
Yeah. Why Nietzsche, Foucault, and Derrida? I wanted to use folks in a book that's really establishing a political philosophy of curiosity. I wanted to use folks who are recognized as political thinkers, first of all.
Yeah.
But that And that narrows it down a little, but it doesn't narrow it down to Nietzsche, Foucault, and Derrida. So within that, I wanted to write about, and I find myself just doing this in general, I want to write about people who speak to me, people whose work I enjoy reading. And Nietzsche, Foucault, and Derrida, all three of them played an incredibly important role in my undergraduate education. I didn't have a class on philosophy of race. I didn't have a class on feminist philosophy as an undergrad. I had a lot of history classes, and these particular figures allowed me to think about what resisting the confines of social structures, of texts and discourses and traditions, and kind of getting underneath, out from underneath, ways of thinking that have been really heavily circumscribed and passed on. And at the time when I was a college student, that was life-saving for me. So I think I do want to recognize that I have an affection or an affective relation to these three folks that no doubt played a role in why they ended up as the political figures here in the episodic section. But more germanely, perhaps, all three of them, as I show, have this this conception of curiosity that's two-sided. They understand, and it's not just a simple like good and bad curiosity both exist, but rather that curiosity is always appears on the scene of struggle, and that there are forces, different forces of curiosity at work anywhere that you look. And so I talk about Nietzsche and his contrast between a curiosity that against life, as he says, and then a curiosity for life. Or in Foucault, there's a curiosity that works in institutions, and then there's another one that works in kind of political resistance movements. And then in Derrida, again, he talks about a kind of curiosity that serves sovereign ends and goals versus a kind of curiosity that's deconstructive and slips out again from under those kind of sovereign moves in institutions, in texts, in literatures and traditions. So I wanted to use these folks to really, really put the point on thinking we have to think about curiosity in the midst of struggle and of different curiosity formations, as I say, at war with one another. And I might just pull out, I'll just hang out for a moment on Foucault. I'm really connected to all three of these folks, but Foucault in particular, he's one of these guys who is, first of all, he's gay, and he's one of the first, for me, he might have been the first queer author I ever read about the time I was coming out, which is, you know, which is always kind of a big deal. So I thought, wow, there's a philosopher who's a little bit like me. But his queerness, I think, was one reason I thought about him, but also he's just this very interdisciplinary thinker and writer, and he's constantly trying to push himself to expand what he's curious about and how he's curious about it. But then he's also really complex about how he thinks about curiosity. So if you think about the history of sexuality, for example, he dives into why is it that we're surrounded by questions that prompt us to name our sexual identities and to name and claim them and to align ourselves with our sexual identities? Why does curiosity drive us there? The curiosity of, oh, well, what's your sexual orientation, or who do you like to sleep with? You know, those kind of questions, versus a kind of curiosity he contrasts it with. What would it be like to have a kind of curiosity that pushes us to explore our kind of sexual encounters and sexual affects in ways that just change who it is that we are and how it is that we relate to our bodies and to other people? What if curiosity did that as opposed to locking us into some kind of box or narrative or label? So he's thinking really deeply about what's happening through the force of curiosity in history of sexuality. And then it's, I don't know if it's a, There's something tragic, but also poetic, I think, that he ends up dying of complications from AIDS, because AIDS is one of these things that it mark an entire a failure of medical and scientific curiosity about what's happening to queer people. what's happening to an entire generation of queer folks. And so so for me, he's this champion of curiosity. He's this complexifier of curiosity. And then he dies at the hands of a lack of curiosity, specifically a refusal to take into account. And I think of all the issues of today in public health and in inequities in public health. Where are the questions being asked of which communities and who's paying far, far too high of a price for that? So I don't know. There's something about him as a person that mobilizes a lot of what I'm trying to think about in Curiosity and Power.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. And I just want to sit with that for a moment because it's so, I'm just really been struck by how people who really fought that in curiosity at the beginning, in the middle, and all throughout the AIDS pandemic, are the people who gave us the most guidance in this pandemic, right? Who sort of knew how to guide us politically in this pandemic. So I just appreciate that, also that connection. And it's striking.
Yeah, it is striking in this moment. Yeah.
Yeah, and to speak also to then one of the limitations you note with Nietzsche, Foucault, and Derrida is their tendency to see curiosity as like an individual endeavor or to individualize the work of curiosity. And I think then to connect to ACT UP, right, and these other social movements. I know that's not a social movement that you focus on, but you do look to the civil rights movement in the United States, to the prison information group in France, and to movements for safe and accessible bathrooms in the United States. To see how curiosity operates in those movements and to make, I think, this really important point about the possibilities for collective curiosity and, you know, the sociality of curiosity. And so will you talk about that move, the sort of, I mean, I'm sort of interested if you read all three of those folks and you were like, this is really individual. And I think there's, you know, like if it was more like you were reading about the Jeep and you were like, huh, there's something collective happening here. You know, I would love to know just a little bit of that. And then about the importance of curiosity as collective practice, especially in movements for liberation.
Right. Yeah. I think the observation, I mean, who knows where observations start when you're a researcher.
I count for something that probably happened years ago that was important at the time. And
Yeah. I mean, I do think there are ways in which the Jeep which is a prison resistance network organization in France in the early 1970s. I think I was certainly working on that particular archive at the time and noticing the ways in which they mobilized questions and specifically aimed to change who was asking the questions and to have it be currently or formerly incarcerated people asking the questions about prisons and about prison conditions and about the future of punishment, et cetera, et cetera. And so I was certainly experiencing an archive of collective curiosity in that sense at the time. But I also remember having worked through the Nietzsche, Foucault, and Derrida, I wanted to go back and I wanted to say, what are the figures? Or, you know, like when you have when you have someone or something that can be the crystallization of a perspective, it's really good for writing. And so I was going back for those, and I noticed that all of them kind of use themselves as a sample curious person, right? I'm really curious in the way that I want people to be curious. Nietzsche's especially good at this, celebrating his own curiosity. But there are other examples that each of them use, the Parisiast in Foucault, or Alice in Alice in Wonderland for Derrida, but they're all singular people or singular forces. And I thought, wow, yeah, well, are they, you know, we need to think about something a lot broader than that, especially given that I'm moving at that moment in the book from a history of philosophy toward a more kind of social-oriented theory. And philosophy in itself has so often emphasized the individual and the individual capacity to think. And I don't want to fall into an emphasis on the individual capacity for curiosity. I want us to grow beyond both of these things. And this is not unique to philosophy. I think this is also much broader. There's a lot of literature on the transgressive power of curiosity from way, way, way back when. But over and over again, it's conceptualized as individual, as either the individual genius who can just poke a hole in a system of knowledge, or the individual rebel who's just leading a social change movement, and everyone's following that one person, and they're the curious charger ahead. So what that misses so much, first of all. That just misses so much. And I think even of myself, I think of the vast number of folks alive and dead who have informed my curiosity, what I am capable of asking and how I'm capable of pursuing those questions and what I find valuable about particular questions. And so I just think, you know, as I think about curiosity as a social and political practice, I want to think about it in a collective or a communal sense. And so, yeah, I do spend a lot of time thinking about specifically political resistance movements. And I don't know, we might pause on the PISAR movement, which is the People in Search of Safe and Accessible Restrooms. And this was an initiative at the University of Santa Barbara in the early 2000s. And what's really beautiful about it is it's a group of students and staff, but also community members, so in and outside of the university, and across kind of disability issues, trans issues, and also kind of menstruation and lactation issues, and trying to think about bathroom access. Who gets to use a bathroom when they need it? Who can... What when they get in there, is it in fact accessible? And what would it take to have a much richer sense of access on that specific university campus? And one of the ways they started their endeavor was through PISAR patrols, where a group of, you know, two or three folks, and a lot of different groups of two or three folks, typically they tried to have a range of genders represented in each group. They went around the university and just logged, where are the bathrooms? What do they look like? What kind of access is there for trans folks, for folks with disabilities, and for folks with families or who have menstruation needs? So there's clearly an active curiosity at the center of this particular movement, not just to say what's going on, but also what do we need, and what kind of world could we imagine? What kind of higher ed world of bathrooms could we imagine that was that were accessible for folks using the university, but also community members outside showing up?
Yeah, if we don't assume we already know who we is here, right? Like, if we take this kind of curiosity in a group, how can we think about the situation we find ourselves in? I love that part of the book, that description of their work, and in the frame of curiosity and how powerful that is. Okay, so can we talk, so you have a chapter on you know, critical disability studies and the role of curiosity there, and we don't have to focus on Eli Clare's practices of curiosity, but he really does get, he gets, you know, there's, you write extensively about him. And so I'd love to focus there if you're game, especially you use these wonderful words to describe his curiosity as both suturing and prying. So what drew you to his work? And then why is he so central to your kind of critical disability framework for curiosity?
Yeah, so Eli Clare is an author who writes at the intersection of disability studies, trans studies, and environmental ethics. I think that's where his work hits. But so I came across him in a number of different ways, and I just kept hearing, well, you have to read Eli Clare. Well, you have to read Eli Clare. And given my particular interest in all three of those areas. And I did. And, you know, people tell me to read things all the time and I try it out and I have to see how it fits. And in this case, Clare is, to me, he's what I like to call a word bender, partly because I'm entirely taken by the Airbender series on television. But a word bender, which to me means he can do things with words and therefore to me as a reader that are just really powerful and really unique. And so it's how he writes that gripped me most. And I had I'm a fanboy. That's just a fact of Eli Clare. And I had the wonderful opportunity to host him at the Trans Thinking Conference a few years ago. And we were walking, I forget, we were walking to something from one building to another. And, you know, we were just chatting. And I said, you know, I think I'm writing a book about curiosity. And he said, he said something like, well, curiosity is really terrible or really violent. And I said, I know. I know. And also, I'm just gripped by the fact, did you know that you use questions on almost every page of your writing? And he said, what? I said, yeah, you have, you know, I've counted every question that you've written, which is true. And it's, you have at least one per page across the books that you've published. And I said, I'm just trying to think about what that says about how curiosity could be practiced otherwise. Because he has a really strong critique of what he calls purient curiosity, which is a violent curiosity that objectifies and spectacularizes other folks and treats them again as an instance of their difference rather than as full humans. And it's a powerful critique and it's a necessary critique. But he's practicing a different form of curiosity. Anyway, so after we had this conversation, I saw him more recently. I think it was at the last Trans Thinking Conference. And he said, Perry, I just can't stop thinking about it. And now every time I write a question, I pause and I say, is this the question I really want to write? So, so that's just more of a personal narrative about Eli Clare and his capacity to also to listen. He said he loves hearing what other folks are doing with his work and to kind of learn about it through them. But he uses questions. So how does he use questions? He uses questions in all kinds of ways. What matters to me is to think about so often people with disabilities are treated as curios or as curiosities, as always being stared at and asked kind of intrusive questions about. But I'm interested in moving beyond that and saying, how is it that the disability community practices curiosity? How is it that someone who has a disability or a disease or an injury practices curiosity? And what would it mean to bring that to the fore, right? We can keep critiquing the objectification and the curiotization, as Amy Marvin calls it. We can keep critiquing that, but we should also do this other work of recovering the incredibly rich practices and understandings of curiosity within marginalized communities. And so when I think about how he uses questions, I'll just flag one particular use I find really powerful. And that's that as he writes, he talks to, he knows that there are folks that he's lost in some sense to a history that has erased disabled people and the richness of their lives, right? That just are erased and a history is not to be had in some sense, but there are names, right? So he'll raise a name and the little bit that he knows about someone with a disability in the past, and then he'll just start asking questions of them as if he's bringing them into the room, bringing them into the book, bringing them into the space of the reader and saying, what was it like? And what did you think? And how did it feel? And What are your connections and your relations and your story? And it's not that there's any way he could ever get an answer to those questions, but simply posing them lends a richness of personhood to people who have been dehumanized and depersonalized. So that's one of the reasons why Eli Clare has what he has in the book.
Yeah, and as I just have to say, as somebody who's really interested in the limits of archives, that practice is so powerful for sort of not allowing what has been lost to be the last word, right? That it's been lost, mm-hmm. right? Like that someone, all we have is someone's name to mm-hmm. be the last word, and to give a sort of life and relationality through the loss is an amazing practice of curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to tell an Eli Clare story because
please.
I got to take a pedagogy workshop with him at my institution. And I was really, it's interesting to me that the conversation you had around curiosity with him, because to me, the space of that pedagogy workshop was one of such a well-supported curiosity. I felt like there was like an affect of curiosity in the room that was really generative and like allowed people to both ask things and to like push themselves to think through things that felt like that he made possible, you know?
Yes. No, I see that so much in his work and in his person. And I think mm-hmm. that just goes to show that sometimes the word, the practice of curiosity is sometimes where the word isn't, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you can, mm-hmm. and you can find and track it there.
Totally. That's great. In your chapter on trans curiosity, you make this observation that's really stuck with me. You say, insofar as trans people are curious, trans objecthood is untenable. And it's just a really effective, like dense sentence. And I know that you right after that observe the limitations of that sort of move to like sort of trap us in terms of human subjecthood. But I think that observation, insofar as trans people are curious, trans objecthood is untenable, I think it's really hard won and works at a lot of levels. So could we talk about it? Could we unpack it a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. This chapter is obviously personal. So, you know, as a trans person, I think that I was surprised to viscerally experience the ways in which I became a curiosity to other people as I became visibly genderqueer or trans. And that, I mean, it changed so much about where and how I traveled and how I moved in different spaces and how I would feel in advance of entering a particular room. And I remember the very first time I was in a room of predominantly trans people, I think it, you know, it was years and years and years after coming out. But I walked into that room and there was something that just happened in my body and just the release and the relief, of what it would mean not to be the one or the weird person in the corner or the, you know, the person that everyone kind of prickles it at in some sense. And that doesn't help, you know, that doesn't happen in every single space, but the potential is always there and it's always in my mind. So this experience of being a curiosity, and, you know, I also need to name, you know, that I, you know, as a, you know, trans masculine person, white, able-bodied, there's a lot of ways in which I'm not noticed also. And I know that this kind of curatization, again, to use Amy Marvin's word, is felt in a lot of different ways for trans folks kind of across our community. But I thought, what would it mean to ask what trans people have thought about curiosity, or how we've, you know, where are my people in this narrative, in this book I'm writing? Where are my people? What are they thinking about curiosity? How have they lived through curiosity? How have they practiced curiosity, irrespective of being social curiosities or media mm-hmm. curiosities or legal curiosities or academic curiosities?
Mm-hmm.
And so this chapter is it comes out of that, and which is, you know, similar to the disability chapter, to say, here's a community that's been curiotized. How do they practice curiosity, and how might that really change what we think about the richness of what curiosity can be from it and within the margins? So that's part of what's going on, and most of the work is focused on autobiographies. So at the time, I was actually recovering from surgery, and I was thinking of other trans stories. I was needing to surround myself with other trans stories, and I just read pile after pile of trans autobiographies. And again, not to say that trans people just have their life stories and that's all that we have, I think, but to say that there's really rich theorization happening in our life stories. And what does it mean to bring that to a political philosophy of curiosity?
Yeah, that the theme of gender as journey that I think you pull out of a lot of different stories, that was a very powerful framing for me to think about a practice of curiosity that that's temporalized in that way, right? That has like vicissitudes, right? Like a journey always has problems and obstacles and resolutions and then things that don't get resolved. Yeah, that was a very, I don't know, that was a framing that gave me a lot.
And I want to grant, obviously, that trans folks aren't the only folks who have a gender journey.
I actually started thinking about that too.
Yeah, I think everyone does. And I think, and I actually think that the contrast between cis and trans existence is it lacks a certain illumination when we think change only happens on one side. I think cis people are constantly negotiating also the pressures of gender and the pressures of a gender binary and specific expectations about their gender. But I do think there's something, obviously, I think there's also something unique happening in trans life where we grapple with a level of change and resistance that is specific to us, I think.
Do you think of the last part of the book as a conclusion? It's not called a conclusion, so I wasn't sure if it was. I mean, I wrote a non-conclusion to my book, so I'm totally good with this, but I'm just sort of interested if Unsettling Curiosity, which is the last section, is a conclusion.
Yeah. I mean, both the first essay and the last essay in the book are unnumbered. And for me, that means that there's something about an intro and a conclusion that one can say, well, that's just setting things up or closing things off, but there's not something substantial about the book happening in those places. But for me, these essays that bookend the book, there's everything, in fact, that's happening in the book, I think, is being done there in the edges and at the margins, and specifically through conversations around Black feminism, Chicana feminism, Caribbean philosophy, and Indigenous philosophy. There's something for me that's instructive to place that, you know, part of the book is to say there is a philosophy of curiosity. And I also want to say, and that philosophy is happening in places that philosophy often doesn't recognize. So that's part of why those particular essays are unnamed as far as intro or conclusion.
Yeah. And then the part of what's unsettling in this last essay, you look at these concepts of opacity, ambiguity, and intimacy. And I think you frame them as being concepts that are companionate to curiosity, but they're also unsettling with and for curiosity.
Yeah. I'm really inspired by Christina Leon's work on opacity and curiosity. And she calls opacity an attendant term for curiosity. And I started thinking about what it means to be an attendant. And I thought about companionship. And I thought, what companions might, you know, maybe part of the problem is that we think of curiosity as alone. Maybe part of that's why we get to an individualistic sense of curiosity. And maybe curiosity needs companions in order to do their best in the world, much like we need companions. And what would those companions be? And so I propose, following Lyon, I propose opacity and lean on the work of Edouard Glissant, as she does, but then also ambiguity, where I draw on Gloria Anzaldúa, and then intimacy, where I draw on a range of indigenous theorists, to say a curiosity that can reckon with opacity, that can say, you do not need to be transparent. The world doesn't need to be transparent. It's not all there for me to know simply because I'm an explorer or a discoverer. But in fact, I can live alongside a certain refusal to be seen. What would a curiosity be like that? Or a curiosity that can also live with ambiguity, that can say, I'm not trying to settle things. I'm not trying to overly define things. I'm not trying to put them all in each of their boxes or their catalogs, right? But I'm willing to stay with and stay interested in and listening to something that is ambiguous, that cannot in fact be settled. Or again, intimacy. One of the vast critiques of kind of a Western colonial gaze is that it comes in and simply needs to know and to acquire. And indigenous theorists, they say, curiosity cannot get started unless we've reckoned with the intimate connection that we have between one another and between ourselves and other living beings and between ourselves and other living beings and the earth and the larger cosmos. Intimacy and interconnection comes first, and then the process of coming to know. So this is an injunction for me of where does curiosity go next? I hope wherever curiosity goes next is not alone, but companion it with these three folks: opacity, ambiguity, and intimacy.
Yeah, it's your book sets up many, many research projects.
And I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah. I know you're exploring some of those possibilities. So what are you working on now?
Yeah. So I'm working on always a number of things. I do think I am a fairly curious fellow, but one of the things I'm really excited about is a book on the poetics of transgender activism. I'm trying to think about not transgender policy, transgender inclusive policies, but what are the ways of, as Fred Moten says, making things and making one another that we practice in a poetic relation with one another as we're doing the activism of working for inclusive change. What happens behind the scenes? What is the way of being with one another? And that work involves archival work and interviews with all over 100 trans folks about their activism and their work specifically in higher ed. And it's a project that is so rich, and also that I feel so responsible for doing it right and to hopefully practice this kind of curiosity I've been talking about, a kind of curiosity that's always in relation, that's always alongside of and with, and that's always listening.
Well, it sounds like going to provide quite an archive as well.
Yes. Yeah, we've been talking about what to do with that. Yeah, I think it's located in around the five colleges specifically, and so we'd like to have some kind of shared trans archive at the five colleges in the future.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah,
that's great. Well, I look forward to talking about that project when it's out in the world.
I would love to.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
No, thank you, Sarah.